All right. Hi.
Hello.
For those of you who don't know me, my name is Susan, and I have been a practitioner of Buddhism and in the Tibetan Buddhism lineage for about 11 years. But I've been coming here a couple of years, yeah, I think. And I also have gone to a number of sittings and teachings at SIM. So I know a little bit and have a little bit of familiarity with that tradition as well. So I've got some notes here, and I will try not to like read. Okay. So when I was starting to put this together, you know, I got like really wrapped up in like, what's important and how am I going to segue from this to that and, you know, all of that stuff. And eventually it kind of occurred to me that I had done a bunch of writing of early years when I was growing up and college years and travel years and all that kind of stuff. And it eventually just occurred to me that that whole period of time, I wasn't seeking anything. That's not part of this talk. There are influences from that whole period of time, of course, but I wasn't really seeking anything. While I was preparing this talk, I really kind of came to understand that my life hasn't really, the direction of it hasn't really been controlled and set entirely by me. And I think that's true of all of us, right? Joseph Goldstein, who is a teacher in the Theravadin tradition, has got this phrase that he got from one of his teachers. And he says that we are empty phenomena rolling along. And, you know, empty, not in the sense, of course, of what he means in terms of, you know, the Buddhist concept of emptiness, but for a very, very long time, I was empty of direction, empty of, you know, any kind of purpose, I guess, in my life. I was just rolling along, you know, just rolling along. Maybe the first 35 years or so of my life. Opportunities arose, and they still arise, that seem right. They're the thing that I should be doing, so I do them. But it isn't like I had anything to do with these opportunities arising. They just were there. They went, oh, good, I'll do that. And I would roll in that direction. So just briefly, the years, you know, when I was growing up, when I was with my parents, I had wonderful childhood, almost bucolic. I grew up on a farm, little teeny tiny town in eastern Washington. I was safe. I was secure. I was well cared for. I wanted for nothing. The positive things that came out of that period of time, I have a good sense of confidence, of self-confidence. I have a really good ability of project management, planning, that kind of stuff. I learned how to garden. I learned how to sew. I learned how to cook. Not that I do it anymore, but I did learn all of that kind of stuff. And I'm comfortable with public speaking. I learned how to do that when I was in fourth grade doing 4-H and FHA presentations. So a lot of really good things came out of those years. What was missing out of those years was any sense of spirituality. None whatsoever. My mother, as I later came to understand, really was very religious, but my father, who was pretty much the dominant person in the family, had no interest in any kind of religion, any kind of spirituality, and that just was not an influence in my life. I was never anti-religious, but it just was very dormant in me for many, many, many years. And the other thing that was missing that really was influential over, and still is to some degree, even though my family, there's just my brother and me and my parents, we were pretty close. I never really had a sense of home, and I never really had a sense of extended family. For whatever reason, my father sort of cut off any kind of contact with my grandparents, either on his side or on my mother's side, with either of their siblings. I had no aunts, uncles, cousins, I mean, I met them once or twice, but I had no extended family whatsoever. So I really am, when I'm interacting and connecting with others, family's a very, very strong influence on most people's lives. And I really don't have a real feel for that. So it's really definitely a detriment in my ability to connect sometimes. About 2 days after I graduated from high school, I was 17 years old, I went on my first adventure. It was my first trip. I don't know when I got bit by the travel bug. I don't know why, but I did, just big time. And so 2 days after I graduated from high school, I jumped in the car with my PE teacher and drove to Maine from Washington and worked in a summer girls' camp. In Augusta. It was great. It was wonderful. It was also the mid-60s, and so I got caught up in the whole alternative lifestyle hippie movement as well. I didn't go to college. I tried off and on a couple of times, but frankly, it just wasn't really particularly interesting, not nearly as interesting as the other things that I was doing. I spent probably the years up until I was about 30 years old traveling. I was either working, earning money to travel, or I was planning traveling and or planning traveling, or I was on the road. I had a really good friend, a guy named Charlie, that I was with for that whole period of time. He's still a very good friend. And we traveled, lots of trips to Europe. Summer in Alaska, a year in Mexico, Central and South America, another year in Southeast Asia, Nepal, India. Just really long, fabulous trips in the mid-70s when it was a pretty rustic thing to be doing. All of it was really free, unencumbered, and very ungrounded. It wasn't that I was out of balance. I was just totally ungrounded. I really didn't have any purpose. I don't remember having, even thinking about having a direction or a purpose to life. No aspiration, no motivation. I was just rolling along. And in whatever country I was interested in rolling to, it was a terrific period of time. I have no regrets about any of it at all. I had a tremendous amount of fun. I had an education that you just can't get any other way. And I was young. I was fearless, you know, as the young people are. I couldn't do it now, not the way I did it back then. But I would not have done anything different than the way that I did it. In retrospect, I think about the years that I was, the year that I was in Asia. We spent a lot of time in Thailand, Burma, Sri Lanka, Nepal, very Buddhist countries. Saw lots and lots and lots of Buddhist artifacts, lots of temples, lots of monks. And, you know, it was all kind of exotic and interesting, but there was no pull. No pull at all. The spirituality, any kind of that type of feeling was very dormant. And even being around it did not pull it out for me. It was interesting. I mean, I'd read Siddhartha and all of that that everybody read in that period of time, but it just wasn't something that struck me in the heart at all. Finally, when I was about 30 and had been doing traveling for, you know, a good number of years, Charlie and I both sort of decided independently, okay, we got to settle down. You know, I mean, this is, we got to get a life, a real job. He had finished college. I had not. So I settled down in Denver and did a bachelor's. And then through a fluke, I got a scholarship to UCLA, and I went to LA for a master's degree. And I mean, I packed up literally everything I owned in the world, stuck it in a trunk, and flew to LA. I knew no one, absolutely no one. I had that period of time was really, really, really difficult. I can still, you know, I was kind of nuts for a number of years, particularly the years that I was in Los Angeles. I was so disconnected and so ungrounded, so totally out of balance. I was really desperate. I mean, I was desperately looking for some direction. I was looking for some connection. I was looking for some purpose, finally. And school was wonderful. School is always, you know, kind of keeps you on the straight and narrow, but the rest of it was really confusing and scary, and I was grasping and clinging. I know now that's what it was. It was really pretty hard. It was not a happy period of time. But when I finished school in Los Angeles, I couldn't stay there. It was like really expensive even back then. And a woman I knew in school said, well, and I didn't know where I was going to go. I couldn't go back to Denver because Denver was in an economic slump and there weren't any jobs. And so this woman said, well, you know, my mom lives in Sacramento. Why don't you go up there and check it out? You can stay with her. So I packed everything I owned in the world, threw it in a car, and drove to Sacramento. And man, what a relief. You know, I was just, I think in retrospect, just the fact that this was a place, and this would have been the early 80s, I could get my head around. Like, you could figure out the freeways. Like, you know, it wasn't scary driving. I could live here. I was from a really, really small town. I'd lived in Denver. Denver wasn't that big of a town back then. It's pretty big now. But Los Angeles, oh my goodness. So when I came here, it was a relief, and I think that I sort of knew that this was going to be where I was going to stay. It just kind of just dropped in my lap. My mother once said that I had an angel on my shoulder, and I would call it a dakini now, or a dharma protector, angels by other names, and she was right. I mean, all of those years, I could have gotten into so much trouble. So many bad things could have happened. And nothing did. Nothing bad happened. I had some really confusing, unhappy years. But, like, who doesn't? Something was guiding me. And I don't mean that in a woo-woo sense. There was just, there's connections. And I truly believe in karma, that there are karmic inclinations that are on my mind stream from innumerable past lives that are having an influence. I mean, I can make choices but there's influences. Things come up and I can say yes or I can say no. And I seem to know, something helps me know when to say yes. And something helps me to know when to say no. I have a Dharma protector. What can I say? I think it's true. When I got to Sacramento, I was still a little confused, but again, I was in an environment that I really started to feel comfortable with. And after a few years, I made some friends and I found a place to live. And then I met a guy named Roy, who I married in 1986. Roy had a tremendous, and still has actually, a pretty tremendous influence on my life. He was the most grounded person I think I had ever known. He was just solid. And he had a very, very strong relationship with his mother and with his brother and sister. And through Roy, I began to get an understanding of what this whole family thing is, what those connections mean. And through Roy, I felt home. I started to develop home. I knew what home was. I now know what home is. I didn't know that before I met him. We were very, very close. We were very tight. We didn't have children. I was almost 40 when I got married. I introduced him to traveling. I wasn't done traveling, by the way. And I introduced him to that. He loved it. We had a lot of really, really good trips. We were together for a little over 25 years. So there was, a long period of time where those 25 years we worked and we played a lot of golf and we did a lot of traveling and we thoroughly enjoyed our lives. We had really, really wonderful lives. Again, not a lot of purpose, not a lot of direction. But I had a job that I loved and good friends, and what else could you want, right? I mean, that was the direction, that was the purpose. In 2007, I decided to retire. And like probably everybody who's ever retired, you just go, oh, there's this, what now? What's going to happen now? I'd worked a lot of hours. I really, really liked my job. Roy was going to continue working. He was a little younger than I. But I really, all of a sudden, knew that I needed to have not structure so much as I needed to have something to build my life around. Roy and I were very, very tight, but he was not my life, right? We were really good friends, but my world did not revolve around him, or his world did not revolve around me either. But I needed to have something. I needed to have something to guide me. I needed to have something to give me purpose, to give me fulfillment, to give me direction. I knew that. I think it comes, I don't know why, but I knew that. That's not unusual. There's retired people here who I'm sure have felt exactly the same thing. I had a friend who was sort of searching about the same time, and she gave me for Christmas of 2007 a book called Awakening the Buddha Within. And it's basically about the Eightfold Path. It's actually a pretty decent book for beginners. And I read that and I went, this is it. I found it. This is the core. This is the philosophy around which my life is going to revolve. This is what I'm going to use to make decisions with. This is what I'm going to use for purpose. I don't know exactly how, but this is it. I just knew it. I just knew it. So anyway, Charlotte and I decided to check out Dharma centers. And we went to Lion's Roar. And I know this is going to sound also pretty woo-woo, but at Lion's Roar, after we have a Dharma talk, all the students stand up and the lamas walk out. And I happened to be standing on an aisle and Lama Jinpa walked past and he took my hands and he looked me in the eye and he held my hands and I'd found my teacher. I mean, there was just no doubt in my mind. It was just this instant karmic connection. And he felt it too. It wasn't just me. I mean, he didn't do that just because I was a new person in the room. We have a karmic connection, and it's been very, very strong ever since. Ups and downs, definitely. I mean, I have a problem with authority like a lot of people do. But it's been an incredibly rewarding and fabulous friendship. At the same time that I came to Lion's Roar, this would have been beginning of 2008, in March of 2008, Roy was diagnosed with prostate cancer. He was really young, he was 57. And it was a particularly vigorous form of prostate cancer. It had metastasized all over his body by the time they discovered it. So I think we both knew, although we didn't really say this to each other, that he was going to die pretty quickly. He was very, very sick, and he was not going to live very long. We went through all the different kinds of clinical trials and all the chemo and all of that kind of stuff. But he was steadily got sicker and sicker and sicker, and he died about 20 months after he was diagnosed. He died 10 years ago this month. So, again, starting about the time he was diagnosed, and for several years thereafter, I just went a little nuts again. Very different than when I was in LA. There wasn't the grasping and all of that stuff, but everything was hazy. I did, you know, caretaking is tough work. That's really hard work. And grieving is really, really hard work. Everything was pretty much a blur. But the thing that was really, really important was I had started meditating. I had started reading Dharma. I had started studying the Lama Jinpa. I went to teachings every Monday night. And I didn't stop. I kept showing up. Like meditation was faux meditation. I mean, you know, I wasn't really meditating, but I was sitting. You know, I kept showing up. And who knows what I read during that period of time. But I kept reading. And so it was working on me internally. And I just see so often where people get in, I mean, I've just seen it years in Lion's Roar, people will be going just, you know, oh man, this is the greatest thing there ever was, and no, 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 no. And then they lose their job, and bam, they're gone. Oh no, I'm just too depressed, I can't come anymore. You know, and it's just like, oh no, 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 unclear on the concept. You know, you gotta keep coming. You just gotta keep coming. Anyway, so that was the Dharma protector. I just kept coming. I just kept going. So in 2011, and I was still a little nuts, that was like a really, really, really pivotal year. That wasn't very long ago. In 2011, short story, His Holiness the Dalai Lama was giving an empowerment called a chakra for world peace. It's something that he gave a lot of empowerments for Kala Chakra. And he was in D.C., and it was 10 days of teachings from His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And Lama Jinpa asked me if I was going. And I said, I don't know. And he just leaned forward and he said, I would crawl through cut glass to go. Well, by that point, there were no tickets left. You know, I mean, this was really close. And he pulled his tickets and he gave them to me. astonishing kindness. So I went to D.C. with a few other people at our Dharma Center for 10 days of teachings with His Holiness the Dalai Lama. 7 in the morning to 7 at night. It was, we were in a basketball stadium. I don't know how many people those things hold, but it was intimate. I don't know how he does it, but it was intimate. It was amazing. And I think that was the first time that I really got it. The spirituality thing is huge. I mean, there were people from all over the world there. And it was just this soaking up this atmosphere and just the vibes that were there. It was just a really inspirational, motivational period of time. So I came back, and just a few months later, I went on pilgrimage to India. I was in India and Nepal for a couple of months. And, you know, what do you say about pilgrimage? People who have done it, I stood where the Heart Sutra was taught. I mean, like, whoa. Nalanda University, which is a great university in the very, very early years of Buddhism, 2nd, 3rd, 4th century, was being excavated, and we could walk around Nalanda. Shantideva, one of the greatest saints in all of Tibetan Buddhism, walked those paths. I stood in the caves that were said to be Ananda's and Shariputra's caves. You know, I mean, it's just really astonishing. It's just, I mean, you can see I'm getting kind of like, you know. So the first place that we went to actually on pilgrimage is called Sarnath. It's outside of Varanasi. And it's where the Four Noble Truths were taught. And I can remember viscerally, vividly walking there and going, oh my God, the Buddha was here. He was here many, many times. He taught here. He walked here. And the wheel is turning, and it's turning right now. And I still feel that. The Dharma wheel is turning right here, right now, right there, everywhere. The wheel is turning. It was just, go on pilgrimage. Whatever you do, just do it. It's just an astonishing thing to do. And then after that, I went to Kathmandu, and I stayed in a monastery in Kathmandu for teachings for a month. And that was my first experience in a monastery, or at least spending a fair amount of time there. Just skipping ahead a little bit for... In 2015 and 2017, I went to another monastery that's on the Idaho-Washington border, just north of Spokane, called Shivasti Abbey. It was founded, and the abbess is a woman named Thupten Chodron. And there's something about being in a monastery. You become one of the residents when you're there. You're not a visitor. You're not on retreat. You become a resident, and you do everything that they do. You just immerse yourself into their culture. It's very quiet. It's extremely hardworking. I mean, monasteries are not easy places to live. But there is this dedication to community and this connection and this dedication and this attentiveness to each other that is just palpable and so, so loving, so, so wonderful. It's not Pollyanna sweetness and light by a long shot. It's very hard work, and these nuns, you know, they don't always get along, right? Son of a gun. But they work at it, they work at it, they work at it. It's fabulous to watch. I leave there every time I go, and I intend to go annually from now until I can't go anymore. But I leave there inspired, balanced, with such dedication to practice. And it doesn't wane after a period of time. It just soaks into you. It soaks into me, anyway. Anyway, after I got back from India, from 2012 to about 2017, my path was really very, very steady. There were some ups and downs and stuff, but I became very involved in Lion's Roar and very, very dedicated to studying with Lama Jinpa. I was very much involved in the day-to-day activities of Lion's Roar, and particularly when we bought the Bee Street Temple. There was no separation between my life and that temple at all. I mean, I lived about a mile away, and I was there all the time. That was my life for a couple of years. But as I approached 70, I told Lama, you know, I'm kind of getting tired. And Lion's Roar had grown because we had brick and mortar, like you guys have probably noticed. So we have a lot of talented and capable people who, you know, need to be doing the work. I don't need to be doing all that work anymore. And they need to contribute. So he has helped me over the years to sort of pull back from the day-to-day involvement in Lion's Roar. I mean, I still teach a class, as Dora Lee said, twice a month for beginners. I lead some practices. I give Dharma talks, not a lot, maybe, you know, 4, 5, or 6 a year. I still am one of the key people in terms of organizing large events, because I've just been around. I've got history, right? But as I was pulling away from that day-to-day activity, something else came to take its place. Lama had been talking up for a few years that he wanted to have a chaplaincy presence within Lion's Roar. And, you know, he was working on me, only I didn't know it. But so one day I'm sitting in his office and I go, you know what? I kind of have some time now. Why don't I take a chaplaincy course? And he goes, oh, well, what a good idea. You know, like he'd been sort of pushing me that direction for about a year. And there is a Buddhist chaplaincy course in Redwood City that's been going on for about 17 years. And it's a year-long course. I think I took all that out. Maybe not. Anyway, so I started taking that course, and what I found at that same period of time is that for me, the center of Buddhism, the very core of it, is bodhicitta and the bodhisattva ideal way of life. There's a lot of other pieces, but everything serves bodhicitta. There's the precepts, there's the path. For me, my main practices really are around the Brahmaviharas and the Paramitas. The paramitas are the activities that I practice to cultivate bodhicitta. Generosity, ethical discipline, patience, effort, concentration, wisdom, skillful means, prayers, strength, and another kind of wisdom that I've never really quite figured out. What the differences between the two of them, but the 10 paramitas, those are the practices and the Brahmaviharas. I mean, that's the core for me of practice. That's the core of chaplaincy. Everything that I do, meditation, sangha involvement, my connection to my teachers, all of the services, they're all in service of bodhicitta. What that means to me is trying to live from my heart. Not just that wing of compassion, though, because the heart, the other piece of the heart is wisdom. And learning through the practices how to balance those, how to understand those, how to work with those, what fits in this situation and that situation. Where's the wisdom? Where's the compassion? Where's the skillful means? You know, that's the practice for me. Trying to have the strength to overcome my confusion and to open to the suffering everywhere, including my own. Sort of in a nutshell, it's trying to move from separation to inclusion. You know, I mean, they talk about non-duality, and that doesn't really say anything to me. What says something to me is moving from separation to inclusion. So I started this chaplaincy course, and I just finished it this summer. And through this course, I realized that there can't be a separation between my aspirations and my motivations and my behavior. They're just all the same thing. You can't separate them. I do all the time. I mean, I'm not, you know, but that's the inspiration. That's the aspiration. My outward expression of bodhicitta, and the expression of the bodhisattva path that I aspire to is through service. Not just service to my teacher and to my sangha, but also to the community. After Roy died, I started delivering meals through Meals on Wheels, and I did that for about a year and a half. And when I got back from India, I took hospice training, and I was a hospice volunteer through UC Davis for about 5 years as a respite caretaker. I got a little burned out of that after about 5 years, and I walked dogs at the Bradshaw shelter. Oh my God, what a sweet thing to do. I mean, these little, oh, it was wonderful. I loved it. I got involved in serving homeless at Loaves and Fishes one Friday morning, making breakfast and serving one Friday morning a month for about a year. That was an incredible experience. But the chaplaincy course, it's organized around the 10 paramitas. Every month we studied a paramita. And it's taught by people. One is Paul Haller from the San Francisco Zen Center, which you may or may not know. Gil Fronsdale, who is an extremely well-known Theravadan teacher and Zen priest and translator. And a couple of women who are full-time or have been full-time chaplains in hospitals. So, and Paul and Gil also are chaplains. So, I mean, tremendous. This 17-year program has been going on for 17 years. These people really have got experience. And the component of the chaplaincy is not just all the reading and studying, but it's writing papers that delve deeply into personal reflections and personal expression of those paramitas and how they play out in your life and how they'll play out in chaplaincy. So one requirement of the chaplaincy class was to do some work in the community. Excuse me. And again, I went to UC Davis, and so I have been a volunteer chaplain in the UC Davis Med Center for over a year now. It is without a doubt the most heart-opening, connective, loving, surprising, amazing, sometimes terrifying work I've ever done. It is the work that is will open me. This is the work. This is my path. It's been leading to this for a long, long time, and this is it. So there was a quote in one of my chaplaincy books by Lao Tzu. Is that the way it's pronounced? It said, to yield is to be preserved whole. To be bent is to become straight. To be empty is to be full. To be worn out is to be renewed. And that's chaplaincy. And that's that for me is bodhicitta. For me, that is the bodhisattva path. That's my practice. So that's all I have to say. So good. I left a couple minutes for if you got any questions or comments or suggestions. Have you got a mic?
Thank you for your practice. Thank you for your sharing.
Sure.
It means a lot. But what's the difference or what is the meaning of bodhicitta, bodhisattva?
Well, bodhicitta is the aspiration to become enlightened in order to benefit all sentient beings. And a bodhisattva is a person who has that aspiration. That's glib. I don't mean it to sound quite so glib. I'm no bodhisattva. I'm an aspiring bodhisattva. Bodhicitta is all there is. So for me, that is it. It's service to others. Not at the expense of becoming a doormat, not at the expense of ignoring my own needs and health and all that stuff, but service to others. That's it. Yeah.
So you practice here and you practice at the Lion's Roar. I'm curious if you felt there's one thing that Zen could learn from Tibetan Buddhism, what would it be? And if there's one thing Tibetan Buddhism could learn from Zen, what's an aspect that you really like here that enriches you that maybe would be nice there or vice versa?
It's just the teachings of Dogen are are the same as the teachings that I hear from the Tibetan masters phrased entirely differently. Gone at completely differently. I'm really not going to give you an answer because I really don't know if I can answer that. What I get from listening to the talks here and practicing here and eventually doing some study of Dogen, which I haven't really done, is just another way of getting at it. It's harder, I think. The Tibetan translations maybe are a lot more straightforward than, and so it really tickles my brain a lot. But I don't really, I mean, it's all Mahayana, right? It's all the Mahayana path. So the teachings are basically the same. It's just the approach is so different.
I just had a question about being a hospital chaplain. Are there a lot of Buddhists, or do you help anybody, or how does that work?
Anybody. I do a lot of Jesus prayers. I mean, and it's just comes out just as easy as anything. You know, who cares? I mean, I wear a medicine Buddha amulet, a little necklace, and it's medicine Buddha who's doing these prayers. But we're praying to God, we're praying to Jesus, you know, we're sometimes, just some universal goodness. But it's not a problem. It's all of the chaplains, we each have our own individual traditions. Most of them are Christian. But when you're there, your particular tradition is only what feeds whatever it is you need to give, whatever somebody else wants. It doesn't matter at all. I do see a few Buddhists though, and they're very happy to see a Buddhist. Yeah. No. But yeah, I can pray to Jesus just as good as anything.
Could you say a little more about your realization that bodhicitta was the pivot of around your practice, the center of your practice?
You know, it's not, I'm not that versed in, it's something that would have to be poetic. It's something that would have to be only a poet. You know, Norman Fisher, frankly, is one of those teachers who could do that. You know, he's a poet. He's, you know, and he's a fabulous writer. Chogyam Trungpa could answer that. He also is a poet and an incredible mystical writer. I can't do that. It's just there. It's right there. It's just, bam, it's there.
And was there a particular time when you noticed that?
Or? No, it grows. It grew. It, for me, I think some people maybe, there's it's like the bolt of lightning. But for me, it grows. And it grows every single time I walk into that hospital. It grows every single time I work with a student. It's just, it just grows and grows and grows. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
I just wanted to thank you. When Jim Hare was getting ordained and this building wasn't ready, Lion's Roar welcomed us as a place to have Jim Hare's ordination, and that's when you were being there every day, all the time,
right,
doing everything.
Right. Yeah.
I just wanted to thank you publicly for, you know, for being part of that, which was a beautiful ceremony that
it
we
was,
had.
Yeah. It was just a blessing to have it.
I feel like there's a kinship between the Lion's Roar Dharma Center and the Sacramento Dharma Center and Valley Streams.
And hopefully one you, that we can...
And you cultivated that too, you know. And I appreciate that personally. Because, you know, when I left, you know, but you got in touch with me.
Yeah.
Let's get together and have some
I'm
tea.
I'm really into, you know, we'll talk more about that, but I really do want us to have a little more contact. I'm really into that.
Yeah. Just wanted to thank you.
Okay, so I'm going to do a couple of dedication prayers before we do you guys' dedication prayer, okay? So this is one that I do every time I sit. In the vast world at large, and particularly in this region, may there be no terror, destruction, starvation, and sickness. May all be blessed to enjoy the practice of Dharma and to live joyously in auspiciousness and prosperity. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish but increase more and more. Just as the brave Manjushri and Samandabhatra too realize things as they are, also I dedicate all these merits in the best way that I may follow their perfect example.